at session number 30388, reel 6.
Ralph Goldenberg, reel 6. Before we go on, could you explain what seamanship instruction you received at HMS Robert Arthur?
Seamanship instruction was very much the minimum needed for anybody who wasn't actually a seaman per se, in other words, having the duties of an ordinary able seaman. We were given some very, very basic insights, mainly into discipline, knowing how to tell the left from the right, by referring to them as port and starboard, and never left or right. And generally, it wasn't necessary to us. We were given a fair bit of marching instruction so that we could march properly and present arms and stuff like that. We could also sort of conduct ourselves, if you like, in a seaman-like manner without looking like landlubbers when we were off the base or off the ship. But generally speaking, there wasn't much. We did have rifle drill and were told how to fire a rifle and that sort of thing, but nothing in any depth whatsoever.
There wasn't the boat handling and knot tying.
Knot tying and rope handling did not come into it, except that on board ship, as you will learn later on, I took part in tug of war, intermess tug of war. That was all. We didn't have anything to do with ropes and things of that nature. I'd learned my bit of rope work as a Boy Scout, and I knew the difference between a reef knot and granny and all that sort of thing. But it wasn't really of any importance to our work or to our work training.
You'd also mentioned the bromide in the tea.
Yeah.
Was the Navy explicit about the recruits' sexual health?
Not at all. Not a word was ever said to us, except for a few sort of rather off-colour remarks by instructor petty officers, said you should stop playing about with yourself and all that sort of nonsense. But there was no instruction given. But it was very patently obvious to everybody that our tea was laced with something, and the assumption was that it was bromide, which was confirmed at some time or another by somebody who knew more about it than we did, and that it was intended to repress our sexual appetite. As I think I said, it may have had no effect on me at all, and probably not on anybody else. It was just one of those things.
Well, if we come then to your time at RNTE, exactly.
Yeah, well, when I report, I haven't actually started by reading it, but when I reported to RNTE South Mead the next morning, the Official Secrets Act was shoved under my nose once again, and the strict rules of the establishment, which was deemed a secret establishment, were explained to me in detail. Not only were we forbidden to discuss our work with anybody outside the premises, we were also forbidden to discuss what we were doing with anybody serving on the same premises and even doing the same things. We were simply not allowed to talk to anybody about our work except our own classmates. I was the only one there in seaman's rig because I was a telegraphist, but I had the advantage of having seen by that time 9 months service in the Royal Navy, whereas all these new intakes who were coming into this thing had done about 2 months in the Navy, which was mainly learning how to march, how to salute and all that sort of thing. Consequently, I was regarded as an old salt, which I was by their standards anyway. And I had to change because I was told to get rid of my seaman's rig and to adopt square rig, as all writers did, which means a jacket and trousers, not bell bottoms and this horrible stuff that we used to wear. And I was officially transferred from being to ordinary telegraphist Gartenberg to being writer SP Gartenberg. The SP meaning that was special. I wasn't a writer, but that I was a writer special. I also, strangely enough, had to change from my Devonport depot, which was my basic depot in the Navy, and where my number was DMX671590, to Chatham, because all these weird writers special were Chatham based, so my number became CMX671590. And there were about six in my form, in my class, all with all different backgrounds. There's one factor in common: we all spoke fluent German. There was a film producer from Vienna, a bit older than most of us, whose name was Murai in Austria, which he added an extra R and called himself Murray, and spoke English with a strong Austrian accent. Then there was a guy from Norway who was a trawler skipper, who brought his trawler across after the Germans had occupied Norway, and during the occupation, I should say, not immediately after. His name was Aase, spelled A-A-S-E, and he was inevitably known as Aspas. Then there was Shaw. He was a German-Jewish refugee from Brazil, who came over specially by boat as a passenger in order to enlist in the Royal Navy. I thought it was pretty good going. Most of us were of a similar age group. I had a huge advantage by being in the Navy so long. I learned a few things, obviously, and I was therefore also told to take charge when my own watch had to get the ship ready for Sunday divisions, which is the equivalent to Sunday parade in the army. We had to get the place ship shape. Everything had to be scrubbed and polished and cleaned and whatnot, and had to be spick and span to be first inspected by the duty petty officer, who then would come around with the officer, making sure there were no bits of dust or crumbs lying in corners and so on. One of the guys in my class was a young Austrian baron. His name was von Roth, spelled R-O-T-H. And he was a very pernickety young man who didn't like to get his hands dirty. So I had the horrible idea that when we had our first Sunday inspection and the petty officer said, "Gartenberg, take charge of your watch, see that you do the dining room and so on, the floors, the cutlery, the crockery, blah, blah, dusting and whatnot. Allocate the jobs, supervise it, and then report to me," which I, in due course, had to do. So I thought, well, I'll teach young Roth a lesson. Scrub the decks, Roth. No. I said, "Roth, I'm ordering you. You scrub the decks." "No, I'll do the knives and forks." "You will not do the knives and forks. You will scrub the decks or your own report." Anyway, argued. He refused to do it. And I had to take him in front of it. I had to go to report him to the petty officer, who came charging in there asking the same thing. And as a result, he got another refusal. He then went and reported him to the duty officer. And the consequence was that Baron von Roth got chucked out of the Navy. We all reckoned that he was temperamentally unsuitable to serve.
Do you know what happened to him afterwards?
I have no idea. Couldn't care less either.
Were all the recruits from overseas backgrounds?
Yeah.
None of them British?
There were British ones, not in my training group. Oh, hang on. There was, Jock, who later became a sub-lieutenant, was my officer in Edinburgh after the end of the war, Jock Forrest. Yes, he was in my lot. He was a Scottish school teacher, a young school teacher, who taught French and German. His German was very good. He was in our group. But the vast majority were of foreign nationality. The officer who had initially interviewed me and was one of the officers running this RNTE was a certain Lieutenant George Chambers, whom, funnily enough, my wife and I bumped into in 1954, because in civilian life he was a customs officer at Dover, not one of your uniformed ones. I think he was a bit higher up the ladder. And by chance we saw him when we were going to France with friends, and he arranged a very, very nice, friendly welcome for us when we came back, making sure that nobody looked into the car that we were in to see what we were carrying home. It was lovely. It was one of these nice experiences in life. But that was post-Navy.
Did that difference in the background affect how everyone got on with each other?
No, I don't think so. I think we all rubbed along very well together. We all had our own particular pals. You know, you palled up with a particular fellow because you had similar tastes. Either you liked to go out for a booze up, or you went chasing girls together, and sometimes many of them went, did their own thing. The only one who never fitted in was Baron von Roth, and that's why I got kicked out, in my opinion, quite rightly. Because you don't need people like that. When you're in the Navy, you've got to knuckle down under and do what you're told. Not always, as you will find out later on. The house we were in was a privately owned mansion which we were told belonged to some titled family. It was a very large mansion with a carriage drive and a flagpole in the front garden, and beautiful shrubberies and shrubs and trees all around, a big garden with a lovely garden wall surrounding it. It was a very, very nice place, and we were told to keep our knowledge to ourselves, and to begin with had to refer to serving on board ship, because it was never a house or a building, it was a ship, and it wasn't left or right, but it was port or starboard and so on. And generally we were told to adopt naval language. We also, the front door of this place, we also had to keep locked. It was kept locked. It was overlooked almost by a window from the what was known as the regulating office, which is where the telephones are and all the rest of it. And the duty petty officer in there would be summoned if somebody came to the door. Our instructions were, and we had to do guard duty outside this locked door, our instructions were not ever to let anybody enter the building unless they carried a pass issued by the building, which all of which we had. Not even if it's Mr. Churchill, it was emphasized to us. And this was where I fell foul of authority for the first, not last time, at RNT South Mead. I happened to be on guard duty and standing there in the sunshine, holding my and a stick and a whistle. And along comes a fellow dressed in army trousers, a naval jacket, a naval cap. This was after the invasion in 1944. A naval cap, jaunting along. Oh, hello. Petty Officer Smithers still here? I said, yes. Oh, can I come and see him? I said, I'm sorry, have you got a pass issued? We didn't have any passes when I trained here. I said, what, you trained here? Yes, he said, I'm one of you. I've come back from I was with the army in France, and they've sent me back on leave. I'm on leave. I want to see Petty Officer Smithers. I said, that's all right. And I unlocked the door and let him walk in. And as he walked past me, I saw he had a pistol stuck in the back of his trousers. I knew I was in dead trouble. And needless to say, Petty Officer Smithers almost came flying out of that door in front of me. God, Berg, you let an armed man into secret establishment? What do you think you're doing? I said, I'm sorry, Chief. I'm calling the duty officer. And the duty officer came and said, Gartenberg, is this correct? You let an armed man enter this building? I said, I did, sir. What have you got to say for yourself, Gartenberg? And it came to me sort of as in a flash. I was suffering from mental confusion, sir. With that, they let me carry on with my guard duty, having made it clear that no one was to enter unless they carried the pass. And I was left to stew in my own juice, wondering what was going to happen to me. Well, it so happens that nothing happened. There were no repercussions, because I found out later, much later, that the explanation I had given was the only one which protected me from getting into serious trouble. And it was obviously genuine. But the thing is, when I was on Sunday division, the following Sunday, Jimmy the One, that is the second in command, who did the inspection, he walked around me in a very tight circle, looking me up, down, you know, with a very serious eye, and whispered as he passed me, "Mental confusion, my bloody foot," you know. But anyway, I got away with this. I got into trouble a number of times there. I must say, I don't think it was my own fault. The second occasion was about a week or two later, when I was woken up very rudely one morning. We slept in six bedrooms or something. Waking up with somebody shaking me rigorously by my shoulder. I was a deep sleeper. As I came to, there was the petty officer with eyes blazing down at me, and he said, "Can't move! You're on a charge for desertion in the face of the enemy." I said, "What the?" And I looked up and I saw that half the ceiling in my room had come down onto the beds of the other guys, but my bed was untouched. I was nearest the door. And I said, "I don't understand." He said, "There was a buzz bomb last night. It didn't fall far from here. The alarm was sound. Everybody had to report to the shelter below. And you didn't come down." I said, "I didn't wake up, chief." And we had a basement which was reinforced with pit props and things like that, where we collected when there was any immediate danger. He was absolutely furious, and he was going to put me on a charge. But I also knew by that time that anybody touching somebody and shaking them, that constituted an assault. And I said, if he charged me for desertion in the face of the enemy, I'd charge him with a countercharge with assault. I did not hear any more on that particular subject.
That visitor, on the previous incident that in, did he turn out to be a genuine?
He was genuine, oh yes. He was genuinely one of ours, an older generation headache operator, as we were called. And he genuinely came to see the old place and see whom he met, whom we could see that he still knew. No, that was quite genuine. We were known as headache operators because, I'll explain, because of the work that we were to do. Our work was to intercept VHF transmission by German forces, mainly ships in our case, obviously. Now, VHF radio waves, I don't know if you know much about them, they travel from the sea level at a very steep angle up into the ionosphere, from which they are deflected down. And the points between the departure and return of the wave, if you like, is where you can hear transmissions. This at sea level is about 10 miles or more. You get freak receptions. If there's somebody in an aeroplane transmitting, you can hear it for far longer, because being that much higher up, the angle wouldn't be so steep. But if sea level to sea level, you know, you get that sort of picture, you know, a very acute angle. We used American sets called Hallicrafters, made by Hallicrafters, a very well-known one. And I saw one at Bletchley Park a few years ago when we visited. I was amazed to see what I'd been messing about with. And we were given a lot of instruction on how to operate these sets, because although it was a simple thing, they had a small wheel about maximum 2 inches in diameter with three spokes in it. So you could just get your fingertip in between the spokes. And VHF radio waves are very, very, very close together. I mean, the stations are very close together. So even the slightest tremble could take you over the top. So you had to have a very steady finger and go around very, very slowly. You can imagine this happening at sea with a ship going up and down and things like that. And in order to facilitate reception, they had a thing called a carrier wave, because that's what you were looking for. A carrier wave was like a sort of a beep, continuous. When you hit a carrier wave, you flick the switch, and that would transform it into whatever was happening on that wavelength. It could be a buoy or a lighthouse sending out automatic signals, or it could be a vessel or an aircraft or whatever. Sometimes you've got freak receptions, we'll come to that later. It was intensive work, and we also were given a copy of the German self-evident codes, which the E-boats in particular, who were our prey, used to communicate whilst in contact with us. I mean, you can't sort of tell your fellow E-boat, do this and that in a code book where somebody's got to go through codes and decode. It's got to be done instantaneously. So they had what's known as a self-evident code. We had copies of this code, and we knew how to react. I mean, I remember only one thing, and it was the most important thing the Germans ever said. If somebody was giving the order, fire torpedoes, they used the expression Tony Dora, two names, Tony Dora, TD. And the minute you heard Tony Dora in relation to the rest of the sentence, you knew what to do. Again, I'll come across that. I was fortunate enough actually to intercept that once. We worked very hard. We had to learn these main things. They had special expressions for all sorts of things. We had to learn everything off by heart. But we had copies of these books, and when I went on board ship, there was a copy waiting for me there. Anyway, further adventures at RNT Southmead was that I was playing football with some of the other lads in a field near a wood. With lovely old oak trees. And when we suddenly heard the air raid warning going off. So it did take long before we heard the sound of a V1, a flying bomb, buzz bombs, we used to call them. They had a very distinctive engine noise, which was a sort of a like somebody revving up a motorbike almost, as they came flying along. And you never knew with these things when the engine cut out. Some of them glided at a fairly shallow angle for a while. Others came down very steeply, so whenever they were within sight or close sound, you took cover. Well, we all rushed off from the field when this thing got near into the wood there. It must have been a funny sight, eight of us standing there with our arms on great big oak trees, you know, sheltering from this buzz bomb which flew harmlessly over. I had a number of other strange adventures there. On one occasion, I'd had all night leave. Now, what happened, we were in three watches. There was a duty watch who had to stay on board. There was the standby watch, who were given limited leave in the evenings after work up to about 10 o'clock, latest they had to be back on board, or the free watch, you know, who had to be back on board at 8 in the morning. I used to go dancing at the Palais in Hammersmith. I loved dancing, and soon had a girlfriend who lived out that way, so I went and visited her occasionally, quite rarely, irregularly, in fact. And one time I got, I'd been dancing with her, and I can't remember, she's, her mother came to collect her or something like that. Anyway, there was no hanky-panky, it was home, back to base. I got back to Southfields about midnight, and I knew that the duty man who was on duty in the regulating office overnight was a particular friend of mine. And they had a sort of a day bed under a reinforced table, which was supposed to shelter you in case of a bomb attack. And I thought, well, I'm not going to wake my poor friend up and nip over the garden wall and come in the back way. So I nipped over the garden wall. It was pitch black, and was making my way slowly across the lawn when suddenly a torch was flashed in my face, and the beloved petty officer said, "I've got you, Heller!" So I said, "I'm not Heller, Chief, I'm Gartenberg." He said, "You came in over the wall, I'll have you in front of the officers tomorrow." I was in trouble again. So the next morning he took me in front of the duty officer and accused me of entering the building by an unauthorized exit. I couldn't stop laughing, and I could see the officer wasn't terribly impressed. And he looked at me, and I said, "Sir, I would challenge that statement. I do not know how one can enter a building by an exit, and number two, I do not know how a garden wall can be described as either as an entry or an exit." Charge dismissed. I got away with it. I wasn't popular with the petty officer, I'll tell you that much. Then another adventure with the buzz bombs, I suppose I must, yeah, mention, we had to do fire watch, which meant that somebody stood on the back terrace which faced south and armed with a whistle. And our duty was, if there was any attack, any approach from a buzz bomb, V1, we were to blow the whistle, which we felt it was getting coming in our direction, and we were, you know, on the route for flying bombs coming into London. So this was a regular occurrence. But if anything was coming near us, blow the whistle, everybody get in the basement, and the guy on duty was to stay on the terrace unless he felt his life was in danger, when he was allowed also to go down. Well, my luck, I was standing on the terrace admiring this beautiful garden, looking at the trees at the bottom, and suddenly the alarm goes, and in a minute or two we hear the buzz bomb. And this thing was getting louder and louder and louder, and I thought, blimey, this is coming right at us. And I started to blow my whistle furiously, and everybody was dashing about getting into this basement. And as I looked up, I saw this damn thing come over the trees at the bottom of the garden. It seemed to me that it was 100 feet high, but I think it was a bit higher than that. And I was absolutely scared out of my skin. I shot down into the basement, waiting for the imminent explosion, which never took place. It went on for miles before it exploded. I had another experience. That was again with my girlfriend in Hammersmith. She actually lived in Chiswick, and I was walking her home down the King's Road in Hammersmith one night when the alarm went, and soon heard a buzz bomb, and it was coming straight down the King's Road, or so it seemed to me, because it was very noisy, and it wasn't terribly high up either. So I pulled her into the nearest doorway to protect us from anything should it crash. And no sooner had I done so than the engine cut out. We stood there braced, which I enjoyed. And there was an enormous bang, and you got the blast, and the tinkle of breaking glass all the way down the King's Road. But nothing happened to us. We were quite happy in our doorway until we left and realized I'd been standing in a shop doorway surrounded on three sides by plate glass. So had this thing been nearer, we'd have been decimated. It was a very unfriendly buzz bomb. It crashed in the park where you used to snog.